Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Rupert Murdoch read about his own company in the Wall Street Journal today. I bet he hates it when that happens. Kenneth Feinberg on how you decide who gets what. And a little bit of bipartisan Freakonomics Radio on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 26th of June. Good to have you with us. So, you know, being rich and powerful and owning an entertainment and news conglomerate is probably a pretty good deal most days. This, however, is not one of those days for Rupert Murdoch. We learned today, courtesy of his flagship newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, that the aforementioned conglomerate, News Corp, is considering splitting itself up. Entertainment spun off into one company, publishing and newspapers off into another. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more on the story.
News Corp could be headed for a big-time breakup. Irreconcilable differences seem to be pushing apart the in-your-face Fox network.
Things are really going to pot around here.
From the more buttoned-up Wall Street Journal.
That's basically what the experts are seeing.
But it's not personality differences causing the rift so much as business model differences.
It makes sense as the problems of the newspaper industry continue.
Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. He thinks the company may just be more valuable in pieces than it is together.
Separating out that part of the company from the other more profitable and growing segments probably will work well for investors.
Columbia Business School professor Eli Noam says there are a couple other reasons for News Corp to consider a split. The British phone hacking scandal hasn't helped the company's newspaper business, and big media organizations haven't been as successful as people thought.
What we're observing around the world is that media conglomerates are actually slimming themselves down.
So what's it mean for the print side of the business? Analyst David Joyce from Miller Tabak thinks investors will steer clear.
There are a number of investors who have not invested in News Corp over the years purely because they have the publishing assets at the company.
But he thinks newspapers are fully in the DNA of the Murdochs and that the papers could wind up as a private company under family control. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
If you're booking summer travel plans on a Mac, you might end up spending more than if you just used a regular old PC. The Wall Street Journal, there's that paper again, reports the travel site Orbitz has noticed that people using Apple products spend up to 30% more on hotels. So Orbitz has started showing them swankier digs when search results come back. All kinds of companies are drawing correlations like that based on brand loyalty. In Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports, we ain't seen nothing yet.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC. What do you have there?
Oh, I was looking at this photo book. I made an iPhoto.
Maybe of the fancy hotel he stayed in on a recent trip. David Evans is the president of Sykester, a digital media research and consulting firm. He says Orbitz offering fancier hotel options to Mac users shows
what's possible with sort of the big data mining movement coming up.
Evans says he's surprised it's taken this long for companies to exploit all of the data they've been collecting on us. And there's still a long way to go.
You know, on Facebook, they know that I live in Seattle, I fly fish in Jackson Hole, and me and all my friends are raising kids. And yet, what are my ads I'm getting? You know, switch to Verizon, which I'm already on, get ripped, and fly to Milwaukee.
No offense to Milwaukee. James Fowler is a professor and social media expert at the University of San Diego. He says many companies are just now starting to figure out how to put their data to work.
Really, the revolution has just begun.
Fowler says companies are using algorithms to create groups of customers based on, say, a few different products they know we like to accurately predict what we might buy next.
And like people who like Diet Coke and Haagen-Dazs and NASCAR. And we're going to be able to figure out exactly what to show those people online before they even knew they wanted it.
Fowler says politicians have been using this technique for a long time. Arnold Schwarzenegger famously targeted Coors Light drinkers. George W. Bush went after NASCAR dads. Maybe Obama and Romney should go after Mac users. They do seem to have a little extra money. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There was a little extra money floating around Wall Street. Today, the major indices eked out a win. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Imagine that your job was to put a dollar amount on a life or on a livelihood or on what fair pay might be for a CEO of a bank bailed out with taxpayer dollars. 5 times in the past 30 years, Kenneth Feinberg has been asked to do exactly that. After 9/11, the BP oil spill, and the financial crisis, to name just 3. His new book about how he came to this unusual calling is Who Gets What? Kenneth Feinberg, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Until you became the special master for TARP compensation after the bank bailout, all of your assignments, if you will, had been some kind of tragedy. There was 9/11. There was Agent Orange. And now here you had this thing that was fundamentally man-made and didn't involve, you know, huge loss of life. Was that different, that TARP compensation job that
totally,
you had?
Totally. Totally different. That was Congress's populist revenge on Wall Street. I mean, that was a deciding what corporate officials ought to be paid was pursuant to a statute where Congress basically said, if we're going to provide TARP public taxpayer bailout money for Citigroup and Bank of America and AIG, well, by gone, we're going to fix their pay and we're going to ask somebody to do that. And the Secretary of the Treasury asked me to do it. So I did it. This was symbolic. This was a sideshow compared to some of the other steps undertaken by Treasury and the SEC and FDIC and the Federal Reserve to try and institutionalize limitations on pay. So I'm not sure how much actual impact it had other than to those people. So it'll remain to be seen.
This is kind of a metaphysical question, I guess, but what is it about the need we have as a society when there is injury or harm done to compensate, to throw money at the problem?
It's been that way since the founding of the Republic. We're a capitalist society. We believe in the free market system. We believe in money as the medium of exchange. Not barter, not a thank you or I'm sorry. In our courts from the very beginning, money is the medium that is used to rectify wrong or damage. And it's always been that way. And I think it's part and parcel of our heritage that when a wrong is committed, one critically important way to try and balance the scales is through the payment of compensation. Clearly, in times of public tragedy, one way or another, money invariably enters into the picture.
I imagine you wrap up every one of these assignments hoping you'll never have to do it again.
That's absolutely right. You say to yourself, as I say at the end of the book, I hope and pray that there isn't the type of national trauma resulting from some disaster, financial upheaval or a tort tragedy, a oil spill or a terrorist attack, where I won't be called on to do this again. But if you're fatalistic about these things, as I have become, you realize that sooner, probably sooner rather than later, there'll be some other call by public officials for a compensation program.
Kenneth Feinberg. His most recent book is called Who Gets What? Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Denver, Colorado is due for its 5th straight day of 100-degree weather today. That's not doing anything to help control the wildfires that have broken out across parts of that state. Tourist towns are suffering. Even the Pikes Peak Railway has been shut down. The fires, experts say, are a direct result of a lousy snowfall in the Rockies this winter. And the lack of Rocky Mountain snowmelt water is hurting companies that rely on Colorado's rivers this summer. From Colorado Public Radio, Megan Verlee has that story.
Whitewater guides manhandle big rubber rafts off a trailer and down to the edge of the Arkansas River in central Colorado. Behind them, 18 tourists pile out of an old school bus and head for the water. As the paddlers separate into boats, the guides start the usual getting-to-know-you routine.
Where have you guys been rafting?
Well, we did this 2 years ago.
Oh, nice.
The water was like...
It was quite a bit higher a couple of years ago. We didn't have much snow last winter.
Not much snow is an understatement. Colorado snowpack is just 2% of normal right now. The tiny amount of snow left is melting fast, so there's no water left to feed the rivers.
It's going to be an interesting year for us.
Rafting company owner Bill Dvorak is a former head of Colorado's River Outfitters Association. He says floating on shallow water requires smaller, lighter boats that carry fewer people, and that cuts into his profits.
Instead of maybe putting six or seven people in a boat, we might be putting four or five. And, you know, we pay the guides the same, and the shuttle's the same, and a lot of the overhead is the same.
During Colorado's last major drought 10 years ago, Dvorak had to sell his vacation cabin to keep his business afloat. That experience was a painful lesson.
And so this year I've definitely hired a smaller staff, just thinking that I'd rather keep the people I have really busy than have too many people and not keep them busy.
Whitewater rafting is big business in Colorado. The industry estimates its economic impact last year was around $155 million. Tourist towns on the state's largest rivers will get some help. Later this summer, Colorado officials will start releasing water from upstream reservoirs. J.V. Vidakovich owns Buffalo Joe's Whitewater Rafting in Buena Vista. He says the extra water will let him run trips into August.
A lot of communities in the area really do rely on the rafters, you know, to not only raft, but to come in and spend their money in the town.
The drought's actually been good for some tourism operators, especially fly fishermen. Lower, warmer water means more places for the brown trout to hang out and more people willing to wade in to try to catch them.
Oh, jeez, that was a big hit.
Greg Felt stands knee-deep in the Arkansas, casting his long line out over the rippling water. Felt co-owns a couple of angler supply stores and runs guided fishing trips along the river.
You know, we're full speed ahead. We never really took a break for high water like we tend to in a normal year.
Word of the great fishing has already gotten out. Felt says this was his best spring in 5 years, and his June bookings are up about 20%. And while he's sympathetic to the rafters, their loss could be his gain.
If it remains dry, if this drought persists, and flows are low, then, you know, the numbers do drop for rafting. And one of the alternative activities that people will probably consider is fishing.
Felt is having a good season now, but what he and all the tourism companies in the Rocky Mountains are really worried about is fire. With trees tinder dry from the drought, one big blaze up here could drive off business for a long time. In Buena Vista, Colorado, I'm Megan Verlee for Marketplace.
Coming up.
One of the big problems in Washington is that the two parties just kind of shout past each other instead of talk to each other, right? Which, according to some old timers in Washington, began when the two parties stopped sharing cocktail hour at the end of the day.
Political Freakonomics libations not included. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials put on 32 points today, 0.25%, wrapped up at 12,534. The NASDAQ charged up 17 points, 0.2%. Settled at 2854. The S&P 500 up 6 points, nearly a half percent. 1319 is the number you're looking for. Single-family homes rose in value this April, a ray of hope for home builders. Pulte Group raised the roof by more than 5% today. D.R. Horton hammered up a 3.5% gain. J.P. Morgan Chase climbed more than 1%. Bank of America and Morgan Stanley each gained around 0.2%. Shares of Delta Airlines soared nearly 6% on news one of its subsidiaries has closed a deal to buy an oil refinery near Philadelphia. The carrier hopes that will help cut his fuel bill by as much as $300 million a year. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for May. That's stuff that's expected to last more than 3 years, like refrigerators. A look at the health of the housing market. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. And my spidey sense and my online sources tell me that actor Tobey Maguire turns 37. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Washington policy wonks are having a very tough time this week, waiting and then waiting some more for Thursday's Supreme Court ruling on health care. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports the anticipation is killing them and their productivity, too.
Washington's many lawyers, lobbyists, and professional prognosticators are turning every possible contortion of court opinions over and over in their heads, going slowly insane.
People now have a mental disorder. Hopefully it will pass after this decision on Thursday. But currently, people are just a tad nuts.
That's Ethan Rome, head of Healthcare for America Now. They'll be at the court on Thursday, supporting the healthcare law, waving signs. Emily Halubowicz is executive director of the Coalition for Health Funding. Her office is also consumed with the healthcare drama, spending time speculating, even discussing the possibility of early happy hours.
You know, starting at 11 o'clock on Thursday for either people to celebrate or drown their sorrows.
I know that a lot of folks are going to go out and drink heavily Thursday night, but we're going to go out and organize.
That's Ethan Rome again. He's planning a 24-hour, 20-state blitz of rallies right after the decision. And he's not the only one. Jennifer Stefano heads the Pennsylvania chapter of Americans for Prosperity and opposes the health care law. She's sitting out Thursday's rallies, but expects to be in Washington soon
to fight something and push back on something. So don't worry. We will be coming again.
Because nothing beats Washington's next obsession, the presidential elections, just around the corner. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Before that election, though, come Thursday morning about 10 o'clock or so Washington time, this sound will be what tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, will hear as they're waiting for the healthcare ruling. It's the signature sound of SCOTUSblog.com. It's what you hear as the site live blogs court decisions as they're handed down. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura has more now on the site and its moment in the sun.
SCOTUS Blog is the brainchild of two lawyers, Tom Goldstein and Amy Howe. They specialize in Supreme Court cases.
You're also a couple?
Yes.
Yes, we're married.
It started out as a two-person shop in our second bedroom.
It was 2002, and Goldstein thought the blog would be a good way to gin up business for his firm. But it turned into something else. 2 years later, SCOTUS Blog was on its way to becoming the go-to site for news about the Supreme Court.
I think the big development was really when we hired Lyle Denniston to come on as a full-time reporter.
That's a guy who's been on the Supreme Court beat for more than half a century. Goldstein says SCOTUS Blog now has an annual budget of about $400,000 and a big-name sponsor, Bloomberg Law. Lately, especially on decision days, traffic on the site has been crazy.
We went from having 1,000 people on the live blog to having 1,000 people join the live blog in a single second.
Last week, that crashed the site's server, but Goldstein says they've upgraded and they're ready for Thursday, when at 10 a.m. Eastern, they expect at least 250,000 visitors. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Teresa Sullivan's going to keep her job. After all, today the Board of Visitors at the University of Virginia voted unanimously to reinstate Sullivan as president of the university. Her forced resignation 2 weeks ago was a case study in decision-making and crisis management and the changing business of public higher education. Marketplace's Amy Scott is in Charlottesville.
As the Board of Visitors prepared to meet this afternoon, hundreds of students, faculty, staff, and alumni gathered on the lawn outside UVA's iconic rotunda, waiting for the decision. Julie Lascaris drove from the University of Richmond, where she teaches classics.
We're seeing the corporatization of higher education nationwide, and I think we need to resist it everywhere it happens.
Retired school headmaster Stephen Yowell wore a straw pep band hat from his undergraduate days here in the 1970s.
You can't put the business model directly over the university. It doesn't work. And I think that's what began to happen.
Members of the board, many with business ties, wanted President Sullivan to move more quickly to cut costs and embrace online education. Though UVA faces many of the pressures of other public universities, declining state funding, competition, indebted students, it's in better shape than most. It has a $5 billion endowment, the largest per student of any public university. David Brenneman is on the faculty. He's also an economist who specializes in higher education finance.
I do not believe this university faces anything like a dire financial crisis. I mean, that I think somehow this board got itself worked up over that issue.
The crowd on the lawn got worked up at the news of Sullivan's reinstatement. Dori Fontaine was prepared. She's dean of the School of Nursing. She'd already sent her husband out to buy a case of champagne.
The only good thing that's come out of this is what it has done is pulled 11 schools, all of our centers, incredibly together.
Economist David Brenneman says the scandal's also shown just how tricky it is to be a public university president these days. In Charlottesville, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. And Dubner, I am told you have been traveling. You've been getting out.
It's true. I've been to England to visit the Queen. She wouldn't actually see me.
The Queen, right.
But while I was there, I had an idea. So, you know, even though with 4th of July coming up, it got me to thinking that even though we broke up with the Brits a long time ago,
yes,
that there's one tradition they still have that I really think is worth borrowing.
So long as it's not like bangers and mash, dude, it can be whatever you want.
No, this is not cuisine we're borrowing. This is actually parliamentary procedure.
Oh.
Okay, what I'm suggesting, prime minister's questions. So this is the session in Parliament. Every Wednesday at noon, the prime minister must go before the House of Commons, which is pretty much the equivalent of our House of Representatives. And he's got to take a half hour's worth of questions from the opposition members, as well as his own party. And it's broadcast for the entire country to see.
Yeah, and over here, too. I mean, I think it's on C-SPAN, right, if you want to see it. It's quite the event. It is confrontational, you could say.
Indeed. It's a bit like schoolboys going at each other in debate club a bit. A few weeks ago, I was there. I heard Prime Minister David Cameron give the following answer to a question about Britain's faltering economy.
What we need to do, both in Britain and Europe, is to combine the fiscal deficit reduction, which has given us the low interest rates, with an active monetary policy and with innovative ways of using our hard-won credibility, which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me.
I love that. I love all the yelling while he's talking.
Yeah,
right?
Indeed.
All right, so as much fun as that is, though, Dubner, how does that advance American democracy, my friend?
Well, here's the thing. Right now, one of the big problems in Washington is that the two parties just kind of shout past each other instead of talk to each other, right? Which, according to some old timers in Washington, began when the two parties stopped sharing cocktail hour at the end of the day. You know, it's a lot easier to demonize someone from another political party, let's say, when you don't interact so much face to face. At Prime Minister's questions, what you've got are these sworn political enemies who actually do insult each other face to face, but because they're there in the room, they kind of share a laugh about it, about the best lines of the day, and they're actually discussing the inner workings of government in the full light of day. I am hardly the only person to suggest that we borrow this idea. John McCain endorsed it back when he was running for president in 2008. We recently asked McCain about it. He still likes the idea.
Talk about the issues of the day that the president, I think, should be up to speed on. I think it'd be great to add to the education and illumination of the voters.
Yeah, all right. So, one, we all know what happened to McCain, right? But number two, what does the Constitution have to say about this?
I asked a scholar named Bernadette Myler. She studies American and British legal history at Cornell. The short answer is that the Constitution would allow, certainly. It would, however, require a bit of collaboration.
So I think that for this practice to work in the U.S., it would have to be by the mutual consent of Congress and the president. Hmm.
Now, Kai, let me make one counterargument against my idea. Opportunity cost, okay? That is the time spent doing one thing you can't spend doing
getting
another.
Getting all economic on me here. All right,
just a wee bit. Right. So I talked to some of the folks at Number 10 Downing Street who prep David Cameron every week for Question Time, and they tell me that it's a pretty massive time suck. You know, you have to be prepared to answer any kind of question about any kind of issue. And it's also a source of anxiety for the prime minister. Tony Blair, in his memoirs, called prime minister's questions, and I quote, Kai, the most nerve-wracking, discombobulating, nail-biting, bowel-moving, terror-inspiring, courage-draining experience in my prime ministerial life.
So that's what you want to do to us, right?
The other idea I have is a little bit easier, probably more fun. Reinstitute mandatory bipartisan cocktail hour every night of the week. How do you like that instead?
We could do beer. Beer would be all right.
We could do beer.
All right. Stephen Dubner, freakonomics.com is the website. He's back in a couple of weeks. We'll see you.
Thanks, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which we believe to be the first ever mashup of George Soros and the 1998 disaster movie Armageddon. Soros said on Bloomberg Television yesterday that we don't have a whole lot of time left for Europe to fix its debt crisis, dodge the meteor that's about to hit the global economy, if you will.
There's a disagreement on the fiscal side. And unless that is resolved in the next 3 days,
everything that can be done to prevent this disaster is being called into service,
then I'm afraid the summit could turn out to be a fiasco.
Did we blow this thing up from the inside?
And that could be actually fatal.
Freedom, we are going down!
This is a great tragedy.
The next European summit, Thursday and Friday, by the by. All right, today the Dow put on 32 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ charged up 17 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 up 6 points. Thanks to Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.